I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Every spring, millions of monarch butterflies leave the mountains of central Mexico and begin their northern migration. This year, they're being followed by a Johnson County native on a bike. She's riding more than 9,000 miles from Morelia to Montreal and back, and she's raising awareness along the way. Then, when patients can't afford travel for life-saving medical treatment, Angel Flight Central steps up. They've flown 22,000 passengers more than 8 million miles. We'll meet one of those patients and a pilot for Kansas City's most charitable airline. Later this week's Local Listen, we'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's actually the 5th District of Missouri for Congressman Cleaver, but he knows who he represents. If you've lived in Kansas City for a while, you've probably seen the monarch butterflies. Around this time of year, in fact, they appear, many on a journey from Mexico to Montreal and back, generation after generation, year after year. Maybe you've also noticed something else. There don't seem to be as many as there used to be. It's not your imagination. The monarch butterfly is in trouble. One Johnson County native has noticed, and she's doing something about it that you and I probably would not, to spread the word about it. She got on her bike and followed them on their journey. Sarah Dykeman is here to tell us about it. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
So how long will this journey be for you altogether?
I started in March in Mexico, and I hope to return with the monarch butterflies in early to mid-November.
Well, that's a long time on the road.
It is. But every day is different, and it's been very exciting, and I'm having a blast.
I do want to hear more about the bike ride, but I also want to understand more of why you would do this. What is it about the butterfly that drew you to this story?
I love animals. I study frogs and snakes, and I like the underdogs. And lots of insects are ignored, but there is this one beautiful butterfly that everyone can get behind, and it's a conservation success story that's in the making. People in cities can help this butterfly. People in the countryside. Everyone has a part to play in this conservation project, and I just wanted to be part of that and spread the word.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, and maybe not everyone learned about the monarch butterfly in school. Remind us about how this works. Why is there this long migration?
So this migration starts in Mexico in the winter. That's where the monarchs go to survive the winter, and usually about in March, they start heading north. And it's actually a multi-generational migration.
And they all go to kind of the same spot in Mexico, right?
They do. So in the United States, they spread out. I'm mostly talking about the eastern population, the population east of the Rocky Mountains. But all of them in the winter are in an area that's about 73 miles wide. So when you go there, you see orange trees because all the trees are covered in monarchs. And when it's sunny, they are flying around, and it is something that you'll never forget.
And you got to see that this year.
I did. I went to Mexico about 2 months early, and I actually ended up making friends with one of my guides, and I stayed with her, and I kind of became like a English teacher / English guide, and it was just a blast. I had so much fun.
So as the spring sets in, they start heading north. And what do they do on the way? What do they eat?
So as they fly north, the females are looking for a special type of plant called milkweed, and they lay their eggs on this milkweed. And they usually lay just about one egg per milkweed, and so they need a lot of this plant. And this is the only plant that the caterpillars will eat. Now, the adults eat nectaring plants, so any type of flowers, usually native plants. So they're looking for nectar plants for their caterpillars milkweed for their caterpillars and nectar for themselves. And they're laying their eggs on this plant, and then they'll die.
So that's why those of us who have flowers in our yard that attract butterflies, we still see them, even though we don't have milkweed in our yard.
Right. But I encourage you to get some milkweed, because then you will not just see monarch adults, but you will get to experience the incredible transformation of this egg to a caterpillar, to a chrysalis, and to an adult.
So it seems like, evolutionarily a dangerous thing for the butterflies to only have this one plant that they're so dependent on.
Well, a long time ago, this plant was everywhere. This was all prairie, and there was milkweed in abundance. Now, with development, we are losing that nectar and that milkweed sources. Monarch Watch, which is out of the University of Kansas, notes that about 6,000 acres of monarch habitat are lost every day to development.
Every day?
Right. So a new study just came out by the USGS suggesting we need to plant 1.8 billion stems of milkweed. I believe that's the number.
Wow.
And so this monarch migration is depending on literally every single person and every single municipality and every single road project to put some of the space, to share some of the space with monarchs.
So we all have something we can do about it. We can even talk more about that in a minute. But I want to talk about what you're doing about it. How does this trip promote the cause of the monarch butterfly?
Well, I kind of consider my trip sort of a publicity stunt, if you will, for the monarch. Mm-hmm. The more people hear about the monarch, the more conversations we can start about the monarch, the more people are going to, the next time they go to a garden store or the next time they landscape, they think, oh, maybe this little bit of grass, maybe we can make this a home for monarchs. And so my trip is sort of twofold. One is just getting the word out, just being a fun, non-threatening, non-confrontational way to start conversations about monarchs. And the other is to visit schools and wildlife refuges to talk specifically about my adventure. With kids, I like to talk about following your dreams, about facing challenges, and about conservation.
Yeah, how do the kids react when you go into the schools?
It's so much fun. Once they can get their heads around, like, oh, that is her house on her bike. And, wow, she has traveled from Mexico to visit us. Then the questions just don't stop. And they're so excited for me, and they're excited to be part of the trip. And
how much ground will you cover before this is all done?
My route is about 10,000 miles.
My goodness.
And I've gone about 2,200 so far.
Tired yet?
Not right now. I got to Kansas City a few days ago, and so I've been resting. I've been going to a few schools.
Because this is home, right?
Yep, this is where I grew up, and it's fun to be back. And now I know the route from Mexico to my home. So,
but a lot of times you're not staying in your childhood home. You are, in fact, packing your sleeping bag and everything else, right?
Yeah, so on my bicycle, I have four bags, and they carry my tent, my sleeping bag, my sleeping pad, food, a stove, everything I need for the road. And sometimes I get lucky and I meet a nice person that lets me camp in their yard or in their basement or in their spare bedroom. But other times, and most of the time, I find a quiet spot off the road and set up my tent and camp.
And is that, you must like that or you wouldn't be doing this?
I love that. It's so fun. And I love turning any old spot alongside the road into my home for the night. It's kind of magical.
It seems like it might be kind of a lonely journey and maybe even an unsafe one at times.
It hasn't been lonely at all. I like spending time by myself. I like biking by myself. And every day I'm meeting people. And my bike is a conversation starter, so whether I like it or not, I'm always talking to folks when I stop at the grocery store, when I stop to get water. And
are there any conversations that are particularly standing out in your mind right now?
They all go about the same. Sometimes I wish I had a recorder so I could just press play.
Just fast forward, get all the way through. What are you doing? What are these saddlebags on
exactly,
your bike?
Exactly. But that's the point of my trip, so I'm happy to do it. In Mexico, of course, I was practicing my Spanish, so those were probably more exhausting conversations, but exciting for me to be doing.
You're following the route of the butterflies. How much are you with them? I have this idea that they're like riding along, flapping their wings next to you on the road. That's not exactly how it works.
That was exactly how it worked for the first like 2 miles. And then the butterflies decided they didn't need to follow roads. And I have to follow the road. So my route is not always next to a butterfly. But the intention of my route was to go places where anyone along my route will at one point or another see a monarch. And if they plant milkweed, they will be helping the monarchs.
This isn't the first thing you've done that strikes a lot of us as maybe a little crazy. You were on this show a little more than a year ago talking about your 3,500-mile canoe trip, the whole length of the Missouri and Mississippi. I want to be polite about this. What's your deal? What is it about you that wants to do these kinds of adventures?
I just love a good challenge. I love exploring, and I love looking at a map and knowing that I've walked that route, or I've biked that route, or I've canoed that route. I like turning a map into reality.
What's been the hardest part of all this?
The hardest part, it's definitely probably been the logistics of planning. I've now decided that an 80-mile day on my bicycle is my rest day, because when I'm in town and have access to the internet, it's all about scheduling events and about press releases and answering questions and updating Facebook and making videos, and it's a lot of work.
That is a different perspective than a lot of us would have about an 80-mile bike ride.
I would say the same thing. It was surprising for me, too.
You've also taken bike trips before. Where else have you taken these epic journeys?
I did a bike trip. My first really big bike trip was a 49-state bicycle tour. We went to every state but Hawaii, and we visited schools along the way. And I remember our first presentation was just awful. It was bad. But a big important part of my trips is to showcase that you don't have to be an expert to do any of this stuff. You don't have to know exactly what you're doing. You just need to go out and try. And my presentation's gotten a lot better. I'm better at biking. I'm better at media outreach. I'm better at all these things because I just went for it and tried and learned along the way.
And how do you, make a living? I mean, you have to support yourself somehow.
Yeah, so I do all the presentations, all the school visits for free. It doesn't cost very much to do a trip like this. And for me, I'm getting paid in experiences. I'm getting paid in interesting moments with interesting people that have invited me to their houses and talking with the kids. And I do end up getting quite a few donations from people that are worried about me or just want to help support me and be part of the trip. But money is the least exciting part of this, so I just try and ignore it.
People can follow you on this journey by checking your webpage?
Yeah, so I have a webpage that is at beyondabook.org, and it has all of my past trips on there, and as well as all my info on my current trip, including I have a little spot tracker, so every night I press this spot device and it uploads where I'm at, so kids can follow me, or adults and my parents too. And also I have videos for kids that are really bad, but they're getting better, and photos and blogs and all that sort of stuff.
Now, you've said that one of the ways you want people to join you on the trip is by planting milkweed, and I think that's not, I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time at the nurseries and the garden centers, but I don't know that I've ever looked for milkweed. How do I go about that?
Right. So milkweed was something we didn't like as much a while ago. And then we realized, whoa, 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 if we don't have milkweed, we won't have monarchs. So every year there's more resources available for homeowners, for schools, for municipalities. And in Kansas City, there's lots of native plant sales. I would look for the native plant sales because they're less likely to have pesticides on them. But also nurseries are beginning to carry them because they recognize that this is important and it's fun. And
well,
yeah.
And you're saying that you don't need to plant a whole field of milkweed to actually make a difference.
No, I've been visiting lots and lots of, they're called way stations, these like kind of pit stops for monarchs and other pollinators. And I've seen some that are just a small section of a yard with common milkweed, and they'll have 50 caterpillars on it. I visited a school the other day, and they had just 10 milkweed plants in their garden, and there were dozens and dozens and dozens of monarchs. So, yeah, a little happens, and it's amazing that a monarch traveling thousands of miles can locate your milkweed in your garden.
I've heard that they return to the same places generation after generation. Is that true?
Scientists are still figuring all this out, of course, and there's lots and lots of monarchs, so I do think that there is some sort of remembering where they go, but definitely all in Mexico. They make it to the same spots.
You were telling me that that the monarchs are out ahead of you at this point. The generation that's traveling all the way from Mexico would be past you to the north by now if they're still alive. But the ones that you're seeing now are the ones that have been born from those butterflies.
Right. And I've been seeing less monarchs. One thing that happened was there was some very strong tailwinds that pushed me, thank you, wind, but also pushed the monarchs north of me. So I am officially slower than butterflies. But now, like you said, they've laid their eggs and they're starting to die. And the caterpillars are growing. And so this is my time to make up some ground because I am faster than a caterpillar.
Well, very good. You know, whenever someone has taken on a big cause, and saving a species, you know, is a big cause, you want to know what success looks like. You're one person. You're on one bike ride. What does success look like for you on this trip?
For me, success is having people start conversations about the monarch, having schools plant milkweed, having kids be excited about this insect that visits their school, that visits their home. And success is just raising awareness and getting people excited and part of this migration.
Where do you head next?
Next, I head over to Lawrence for the Monarch Watch's open house, and then on up towards Minneapolis.
Minneapolis, and then what's the northernmost point?
I'll be heading through the UP and the United States, and then
the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Okay,
thank you. And then over, basically, just due east towards Montreal in Canada. So just southern Ontario.
Well, that's Sarah Dykeman. Her website is beyondabook.org. Sarah, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking a few minutes to stop by and talk with us.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we'll turn from butterfly wings to airplane wings on planes that carry patients in medical and financial need. Maybe you've heard of angel flights. We'll meet a pilot in the program and a patient who these flights have helped. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske today. Yesterday, we discovered why social awkwardness can actually be a good thing. And we learned how the discovery of oil on Osage Indian land led to a series of murders in the 1920s. You can find both those conversations online at kcur.org/uptodate. Steve Kraske will be back tomorrow. He'll speak with the author of a new biography of Richard Nixon to find out why readers are drawing uncanny parallels with President Trump. But now, 22 years, 8 million miles, 22,000 passengers. Those are impressive numbers, and they aren't from an airline. They're from Angel Flight Central, a Kansas City charity that's connecting patients with the medical care they need but didn't think they could afford to get to. Today we're talking about the program with some people who know it very well. Ron Davis is one of the pilots with Angel Flights. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you very much for having us, Brian.
And also joining us is Brendan Snegus, who is the Director of Outreach and Development for Angel Flight Central.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're glad you're here. And also David Parnell, who is from Gardner, Kansas. He's been a passenger on these flights. David, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I want to start with you, David. What was the medical situation that led you to need this help?
I had a kidney transplant a little over 5 years ago and subsequently had some complications and things that entailed me needing to go about 500 miles away for medical follow-up, and my kidney transplant was in relationship to polycystic kidney disease, which is very prevalent and a hereditary disease. The kidney transplant itself went well, but I had subsequent issues, and through the years, it's been a little over 5 years, but through the years, my kidney has maintained, kind of sustained a state of unhappiness, as it were, and so I have to go frequently up to the facility that I go to, the medical specialist that I do go to.
Now, a lot of people would say, you know, okay, so pile into a car and get ready for the drive, or book an airplane ticket. Why didn't you do that? Why couldn't you do that?
Well, and for a number of times I did. I was raised to kind of take care of my own and figure it out, and God would provide, and so that was for the first year or two, that was what we did do, myself and my other half. And I think there kind of came a point where it was difficult to call them vacations, but it mm-hmm. did take time and it took money and the trips back and forth.
Seven or eight hour drive on
correct.
Gets a little old, I think.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And because of my history with blood clots and other issues that kind of came out of the transplant, it was generally a two-day drive. We'd go about halfway and spend the night, and then the rest of the way. Over time, it did get expensive and cost prohibitive. My other half got to where she didn't have leave time to take off from work. And so it came to where I discovered Angel Flight.
I want to hear more about your experience with Angel Flight, but let me ask you, Brendan Snegus, what does Angel Flight Central do?
What we do is we provide access to medical care long distance through a group of angels, which are about 380 volunteer pilots who love to serve people that they've never met before, utilizing an aircraft that could be for hobby or for business-related purposes. They just put themselves out there to help people in need.
How long ago did this start?
Started here in Kansas City 22 years ago, and with an 8-year-old Korean adopted boy who needed help. And the pilot who assisted him enjoyed the experience of being able to utilize his aircraft so much that he came back to Kansas City and started to motivate other pilots to get involved. So that first flight is now almost 24,000 flights later.
Wow. Are there certain medical issues that that are especially common in the people who you assist?
Cancer is... Cancer and rare diseases, they'll have an issue where they've run out of options in their particular city, so they will be referred. There's a local woman out east called recently, and her local hospital had basically given her three surgeons who could assist with her heart disease. And those three options were Houston, Texas, and Rochester, Minnesota, and L.A., and she was panicked because it's nice to have options, but...
She couldn't possibly afford to go to these places.
Correct. And so that was a great phone call to have.
Where all do you fly these flights out of? I know it started here in Kansas City.
Your
headquarters is down at Downtown Airport, right?
That's correct.
But where all do you fly from now?
It's kind of funny. Our office is basically a local municipal small airport closest to the patient's front door. We handle a 10-state region, basically Kansas City up to Canada as far east as Indiana. And so when the passenger calls us, we will identify the smallest or the closest airport to their front door. And if it works with the pilot, then that's where we'll meet them.
Is this the only program like this in the country?
There are several that we are friends with and work together with to make sure that people can get across the country without question.
Well, I want to ask more about that, too, but let me bring in one of the angels you mentioned, Ron Davis. Ron, you are a pilot?
Yes, I am.
How long have you been flying?
Well, I started back in 82, flying for my business, and found it a great way to service customers and be in Illinois in the morning and western Kansas in the afternoon, back home that night. So it proved to be a great way to travel, and been flying ever since.
Now, how'd you hear about Angel Flight?
Well, my partner Robin and I went to Oshkosh back in 2010. He had heard of the organization, I had not, and he motioned to me, and we walked over to the booth that Brandon was helping out, and met him, and I thought, wow, what a great way to use my airplane and help people. And I was, signed up immediately and started flying patients.
I have to think, I don't know a whole lot about being a private pilot or having your own plane, but I sure know that it's expensive to fly.
It is.
Are you making a pretty enormous financial investment by being a volunteer?
Yes, it is. Because all of the pilots either use or rent an airplane, pay for the fuel and any related airport charges or overnight stays that we may have to incur.
Wow. But it's worth it for
you. Oh, I love it.
Why? What do you get out of this?
I do it for the hugs. Every passenger is just so kind and heartfelt and just are so thankful that we're able to help them out. And it's just gives me a lot of great feelings when I can do this and help others.
How many people have you flown?
I think I've hit about 75 missions. And most of the time it's the patients, and then they have a significant other or a spouse or maybe a child to help them. I think about 75 flights over the last since 2010.
And when I take a commercial flight, I don't get to know my pilot really at all. Maybe I hear their voice on the intercom. Do you get to know the people
we
that
do.
You're taking?
Yes, we do. And I'll get an email from Angel Flight and telling a little bit about the patient and the passenger and why they're flying. And then I always make an effort to call them when I get the assignment and talk to them, see how they're doing, if they have any questions about the flight or any special needs that they might have. And we do get to know the passengers very well.
Well, David Parnell, as one of those passengers, take us back to your very first Angel flight. What was that experience like?
My very first one was, of course, a little apprehensive, not knowing, and very humble. I was almost embarrassed, I guess.
Why?
I felt it unusual to be the receiver of those kinds of services. Not necessarily a vanity thing. It just felt like I shouldn't have to rely on somebody to provide me a service like that. Hmm. The trip was just phenomenal. The pilot, it was like we'd known each other for years. Of course, we sat in close quarters in the cockpit on the flight and got to know each other quite well.
Was that your first time in a small plane?
No, wasn't my first time in a small plane, and flying doesn't bother me.
Okay.
So, fortunately, that I kind of look at it as an adventure. And have made a point to kind of get to know my pilots, and I ask a lot of questions and kind of make it an event, not just a medical trip per se.
Sure. Where do you fly out of for these flights?
They actually have picked me up within 2 miles of my house.
Wow.
They make a point to schedule the flight as conveniently as possible. And there's an airport 2 miles from my house.
Down in Gardner.
I've been picked up there. Yeah, it's just a phenomenal service.
I have to think, Brendan Snegus, that the logistics of all this must be pretty remarkable. It's not just even lining up the pilots and the flights; it's getting them the ground transportation once they get there.
Correct, and that is the screening process is one that we work on diligently, and we want to make sure that the passengers are aware of what. What's before them, as well as educate them on flying small general aviation aircraft, as well as we want to make sure that the flight itself isn't going to do any additional harm or reverse any treatment that they might be having.
These are not life flights. These are not medically equipped planes.
That is correct. These the passengers must sit upright and be strong enough to get up in and out of the aircraft. And so we'll take them through a series of those things, and ground transportation is one of those things that we'll talk to, as well as there's nothing more important than safety. And so we want to work with each passenger and making sure that they have a very solid backup plan just in case there's weather or a mechanical, or they're not feeling up to being in a small plane the day of, and working them through those backup plans. So if things do fall through or we get postponed or canceled, then we just rely on that backup plan, which is typically getting in the car and driving.
We talked about kind of the enormous costs of flying, and a lot of the pilots, the angels themselves, bear a lot of those costs. But obviously, all those logistics and things add up for the organization as well. You're handling this all one patient at a time. How is this sustainable? It's hard to imagine how this works.
The sustainability comes with the advances in medical technology and the rareness of diseases. Situations like Dave with his transplant and children heading to special needs camp and working very, very hard to maintain the organization functioning as efficiently and effectively as possible. believe it or not, for 10 states, we have 5 staff that are doing the work. And so we keep things run to a minimum, watch the bottom line very closely, and make sure that we thank pilots like Ron as much as we can, because Ron's humbleness is to the tune of $2.3 million is what our pilots donated last year in service that for fuel and a cost of aircrafts.
Wow.
And so it's a tremendous donation on their part.
Do you ever say to a potential passenger, hey, we've crunched the numbers and honestly, we should probably figure out how you can get an airplane ticket on a commercial flight.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And yes, when we'll work through them, we don't want the disease process itself to break you. A national newspaper on Saturday declared that medical expenses is the number one cause of bankruptcy today. And we don't want the passengers to get to that point. However, if they do have a little nest egg, then maybe we can split it and have them drive once, maybe they could pay for a ticket once, and then maybe that third time we'll step in and provide the service, or we will certainly work with everyone.
Sounds like do you have caseworkers or people who individually work with the patients?
Yeah, we have a flight coordinator and a director of flight coordination that work one-on-one with all of those callers, and then a team of 3 great office volunteers that come in throughout the week to assist.
So, Ron Davis, what's the longest flight you've taken?
Well, I've probably 2 of them down to Houston, Hobby, and there's a great medical facility, MD Anderson, down there. And then also flew a child to Cincinnati. And one of the hospitals out there. So that was about a 4 or 5 hour flight. 4 or 5 hours each way, so made for a long day.
I bet. And are there any passengers that really stand out in your memory?
Oh, and quite a number of them. The first passenger I had ever flown was Gus, and he lived in Kansas City, and when we were flying, we started some small talk, and I asked him what he did, and he said, oh, well, he's a pharmacist. And I said, oh, well, my company owns SpeedScript pharmacy software. And he said, oh, my gosh, we use that in my in my pharmacy. So I had he had been working part-time there, and so we had instant rapport and kept in touch. And I probably have flown him maybe a dozen times, and Gus was one of those people that I think he had 180 flights. Mm-hmm. Over the 4 or 5 years that wow. He had used Angel Flight until he finally passed away in, I think it was December of 2014.
Gus was a local resident who was told he needed to be in Houston every Thursday, and he tried to continue to work and be a family man, and using Angel Flight Central, we could come closer to making that happen.
Yeah.
For him.
That story, Ron, makes mm-hmm. me think about one of the hard parts of this, which is that you're dealing with people who are sick, and yeah. And I imagine that some of them, in spite of your assistance, don't make it. That must be very difficult.
It is, and you become attached. Many of these passengers I've flown a dozen times, and one of the probably the hardest, most difficult are the kids. There was a 6-year-old Braden who I've flown about 6 times from Springfield, and he was just a cute little boy. And one day on one of the flights, I had him sit up in the co-pilot's seat, and he put on his headset and put on my Angel Flight badge, and he was just in seventh heaven at that time. And when we landed, he got out of the airplane and said to me, Captain Ron, when I grow up, I want to be a pilot so I can help you fly Angel Flights. And that was really a memorable experience. And there was another one, little Lucy. She was 1 year old, And I flew her and her mother from Columbia, Missouri, up to Omaha. And when the mother got out, she just gave me a big hug and gave me a thank you card and had actually made some food, some sweets, and she gave me as a thank you.
So you do it for hugs and for the food.
Hugs and food, yes, sir.
That's the only person who flies for the food that I know. Let me ask you, David. I mean, I know you've spoken to some groups about what this program has meant to you. What do you tell them? What is in a nutshell, what has it meant to you to be part of these Angel Flights?
I think the main message that I try to share is that this is a service that's available to everyone. It's not exactly based on financial limitations or financial requirements. It's just based on need, and it's a service that is providing just untold number of hours and assistance for folks that I don't know. It's I've kind of become an ambassador, I guess, for Angel Flight Central and like to spread the word. I know that there's a lot of people out there that don't know mm-hmm. about Angel Flight mm-hmm. Central that would certainly benefit from the services, as well as their administrative costs. Runoff donations, and that's important too for their survival.
Well, let me ask you quickly about that, Brendan. Who is eligible to receive these flights?
There's a good list on our website, that angelflightcentral.org, that you can look at, but mainly folks that are 100 plus miles in distance. They have to be strong enough to get in and out of the aircraft and sit upright and take care of themselves during the flight itself. There's some weight limitations on luggage and what they can bring along with them.
And is there does one need to demonstrate financial need?
No, it's a conversation. It's just a simple conversation, but there's not a formula.
And very quickly, do you have enough pilots or are you looking for more?
We have a great group of about 380 very dedicated volunteer pilots. The need is different in every city and state. What we really need is public education and awareness to fly more people in need.
That's Brendan Snegas. He's Director of Outreach and Development for Angel Flight Central. Ron Davis is one of those angels, one of the pilots who does some of these flights. And David Parnell from Gardner is a passenger has been a passenger on some of those flights. Gentlemen, I want to thank all three of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back now after a couple weeks of, was it rest and relaxation, Bill?
It sure was, Brian.
Well, I'm glad. I've missed you while you were away.
Thanks so much.
So Bill's brought with him this week's local listen. And what are we listening to this week, Bill?
We're going to listen to a track by Ensemble Iberica, a Kansas City-based folk lyric group that's dedicated to the music of Portugal, Spain, and Central and South America.
So it's Kansas City based, but this is a particularly culturally specific sort of music.
That's right. The group has a concert Monday that's dedicated to the music of Mexico. So I've selected a track called Deja Salga La Luna that is typical of what they're going to be playing on Monday.
And what is the Kansas City connection for this bunch of musicians?
There's a man named Bo Bledsoe, who is one of the most exceptional musicians in Kansas City. He plays stringed instruments and leads several ensembles, including Ensemble Iberica.
So Ensemble Iberica, you mentioned Bo Bledsoe. I understand he also oversees the Turkish jazz group in town, right?
That's right. There's a band called Ala Turca that he plays with that he calls it an oral handshake between Turkey and the jazz community of Kansas City. And it's great. He has a country ensemble called Fool's Gold that plays honky-tonk music. He's also in the group The Bacaria Soloists.
Okay, wow. So I think that's him we're hearing now, but there's more to this track that we're listening to. Let's give it a little listen.
Salga la luna, deja que se meta el sol. Deja que llegue la noche pa' que empiece nuestro amor. Deja que las estrellitas me llenen de inspiración para decirte cositas muy bonitas, corazón. Yo sé que no hay en el mundo amor como el que me das, y sé que noche con noche va creciendo más y más, y sé que noche con noche
I like that part, Bill.
Just makes my knees buckle.
So what else is part of this this concert that's coming up this week?
Well, that's the voice of Pedro Cupa Barrera, who obviously has an amazing voice and is an exceptional talent as well. She'll be part of the concert, as will the classically based vocalist Victoria Botero. There'll be a marimba quartet, Sol de Chiapas. All these are Kansas City-based artists. There'll be a Bolivian guy who lives here in Kansas City named Armando Espinoza. There'll be all kinds of music, but it will all be Mexican-themed.
Okay. Well, something to look forward to. That's Deja Que Salga La Luna from the 2014 album Colonia by Ensemble Iberica. Bill, thank you so much for being here.
So glad to be here.
Always a pleasure. You can, of course, find more of Bill's work and find all of our podcasts and our previous programs at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Steve Kraske will be back in the chair tomorrow. Join him to find out why one historian's biography of Richard Nixon is drawing uncanny parallels with President Trump. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.